Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to session number 162. If you admit to anybody that you've been to this session, entitled The Group, LDS Hippie Culture and Drug Recovery, make sure that they know that you did not inhale. Our speaker is Spencer Ellsworth, rather interesting chap, according to his bio. Well, my name is Jeff Needle. I'm the chair. He lives in Bellingham, Washington. He's a graduate student in English at Western Washington University. He works as a literary agent for the Lori Perkins Agency. Forgive me, I've never heard of them. Who are they?
Literary agency out of New York.
I see. How can you work with an agency in New York when you live in Washington?
The internet.
I see. The internet is magic, isn't it? Yes. And so it says here, if you have a novel in your heart, be sure to chase him down. He'll be glad to give you a $100,000 advance while you're here and get you on your way. We have no responder for this session. There will be a lot of group interaction. That is the hope of the speaker. So I introduce to you our speaker today. Oh, please, if you have cell phones, turn them off. And remember that recordings of the session will be available after the session. Thank you.
Thanks for coming. I wanted to ask, first of all, did anyone come who was actually in the group? Because I invited them. What's your name?
I'm Steve Richardson. I wasn't in the group. I went on a survival trip that the group sponsored.
Oh, cool. Well, right on. Well, that's good. Awesome discussion. I invited some people from the group, but it's just a phone message thing. So, you know what, I really hate it when speakers talk out sacrament meeting and undermine themselves. Like, what's the one about, I'm going to start this talk with either a joke or a lie, and I'm happy to be here? Or the one about, oh, the bishop made me do this. So I hate that. Having said that, I had no idea they were going to give me an hour. So you might end up playing a little hangman here, brothers and sisters. So the group was there's a group of recovering drug addicts, hippies, in the late 60s and early 70s who were the first people to really unite the ideas of the hippie movement and the LDS church. And you really can probably not think of anything more different than the hippie movement and the LDS church, especially in the 60s and 70s. And this is a picture of them. My parents are in there. My parents met in drug rehab. It's a very romantic story. And so the group was a... To me, it's an example of how the church is sort of pushed to evolve by the needs of the members. They started meeting in someone's basement. You know, they had all been on drugs. They were all trying to recover, and they were all trying to be good Mormons, but of course they went to church with their long hair and their hippie ways, and that was just looked down on very oddly. And eventually this group swelled, got huge, you probably know about this, and became recognized by Elder Marvin J. Ashton, came down and organized it a lot the same way we might organize a single FHE at BYU. So I'll talk a little bit about this, the story's involved, and I have my outline on my computer. You guys get to see the outline with me, or you can read along. All right. Just here. So, who's read? Any of you guys read "Goodbye, I Love You" by Carol Lynn Pearson?
Yes.
No.
Yes. Okay. So you know the story of Carol Lynn and Gerald, right? Well, Gerald was one of the people. I don't know if he's in this picture. This is horribly pixelated. The only people I can pick out are my own parents. But Gerald was, according to Carol Lynn, he was on a really vital search because of who he was as a gay man. He was searching for people to share this notion of identity and sexuality, and really convinced that the gospel of Jesus Christ could heal anything. So it seems that at some point Gerald came in contact with some recovering drug addicts. I don't have permission to use everyone's name, so I'm going to call this guy Bill. That's his first name, and I'm not going to use his last name because I haven't gotten contact, but Bill was the first of these. Bill was not your typical drug addict. Bill was a father of two. He had a premature child, and he started working two jobs. And someone told him about speed. Could keep him awake, get a second job. So he started taking speed, right? And then Bill started taking just about everything you can think of, dextrin and heroin. And there's a very passionate story. And Bill eventually gets on LSD. And what you find a lot on the group is this reiteration of the idea that LSD was a very spiritual drug. This was something the mainstream church did not want to admit, but almost everyone in the group said, "I've had these really spiritual experiences on LSD." I'm going to read a little bit of one of Bill's, I think it's Bill's, LSD trips. It's someone in the group. "I didn't know much about LSD. I had heard a few things, but I thought it was just another drug. One night I decided to take it. I had an experience which literally bowled me over. My first experience with LSD, I felt like I was floating out of my body. I thought that I was seeing the universe with all its stars and galaxies, and I thought, this must be what Abraham saw in the beautiful vision that the Lord showed him. So that gave me a really strong desire to repent of my sins, to stop taking other drugs. I started using only LSD. I'd fast and pray each time before I dropped it. You see how deceived I was? I thought this was really a spiritual experience. I fasted and prayed so that God would help me to have the best possible experience. And after a period of time, two things started happening. First, I began to get the strong feeling it was just not possible to get to a spiritual place with a chemical. Heavenly Father didn't set it up that way. You do it His way or you don't have it. Second, I began to discover that the fruit of the tree of dope is rotten. It has wormholes in it. You bite into it and it's hollow. You eat a lot of it, it doesn't fill you up. You feel good." So Bill shared this experience with the group numerous times where he was standing over a toilet. He had dumped all his drugs in the toilet, except the LSD. He was on his knees and said, "Please, God, please don't make me give up my LSD. Don't make me give up my LSD." And finally, he threw the LSD in the toilet. And he found out his mother had been praying for this. But what Bill realized, and Gerald realized, that no one in the church really conceptualized, was that this hippie movement was not so diametrically opposed to the church. It was a genuine search for peace and love and brotherhood and enlightenment through drugs. And their whole concept was, well, let's just get these people together and tell them that the gospel is the authentic ingredient and the drugs are the synthetic ingredient, you know? And once you taste the real thing, you won't be able to go back. They used to say prayer gets you higher longer. These are not really strange ideas to most of us. We've probably heard them from any organization that's trying to bring people back into the church, or any church who've been on drugs. But, this is 1971. This is the age of the priesthood ban and the fighting the ERA, and this is not the church that we... This is a church that was really... had no idea what to do with this hippie movement. So, just a minute here. To bring up another image. Gerald Pearson wrote a book called There Is a Way Back, which became a kind of manifesto for the group. And I'll show you. It has a picture of Bill on the cover that was actually painted. Oh my gosh. Something happened to the color on my computer.
It's okay.
All right. Yeah, you guys get the idea. He's actually wearing a brown shirt. But you could use your imagination here. Hopefully some of you are colorblind. Oh, okay. Good. Well, there's a way back. I have a copy here. In fact, if any of you know Carol Lynn, she still has some floating around if you're interested. It's actually not so much a manifesto to recovering hippies, which it is, but it's also a manifesto to the rest of the church. I want to read a little. Let's see. Well, it had a lot of experiences like, you know, I had to go to LSD for a spiritual experience. So what Gerald starts out doing is by talking about, he has a great quote in there, that this movement is going to be remembered as one of the hungriest times in history. Hungry for the things of the Spirit. And, you get quotes like, "After taking LSD, I thought I understood what they were talking about when they spoke of peace and love and brotherhood. I thought I had it all figured out." This is a statement from an LDS youth. And yet, moving from there, Gerald actually starts to criticize the state of the church at the time pretty heavily. He creates this sort of patchwork picture. The kid growing up in a home without love, whether it was self-satisfaction, you know, this sort of success in their jobs, whether it was stake boards. This was also before the era when we started telling people don't spend so much time in church. You'll ignore your family. He started to create these pictures of all these kids who were really growing up in a community where the church was so self-satisfied, almost stagnant. Now, they don't come out and say that, but they do say some of these experiences these kids had. I'll read some of them. Some of them are funny. But here's the son of a professor at a church institution. He says, "Sure, my folks loved me if I did all the right things. When I played Mozart, Dad loved me. When I played the Beatles, he didn't." That's actually my dad. I think that's kind of petty, but I decided to read it just to embarrass him. The daughter of an active Latter-day Saint family. I remember at mealtimes my mother would always end up leaving the table in tears because of something my dad said. Never got to eat one meal without somebody getting upset over something really stupid. The third son to go into drugs from a most admired family in the community. Mom was on us almost every minute to do the right thing, to measure up to goals that she and Dad set down. I never yet had a chance to talk about what I wanted, only what they wanted from me. Son of parents both active on stake boards. Dad worked so hard and was so busy all the time we never got to see him. Mom seemed to be just as busy. I think maybe subconsciously I started resenting the church, because it seemed to be more important to them than I was. Another daughter. After I decided that drugs were out of it and I had been away from the scene for a while, my mother was still crying about what I had done to her, about how I'd hurt her, and two, it was always this I told you so thing. Expected 10 years from now. She'll be saying that. Gonna read another section from the book. Heavenly Father is the one who made us. He understands our natures and our needs more than we do. Yet we continue to conduct our searches for fulfillment with no reference whatsoever to Him. If we did, our destinations would be vastly different from what they are now. They would certainly be different in the life of the person on drugs. So this is a real heavy criticism of the state of the church. You know, they're not coming right out and say it, but they are saying there's not a lot of love in these houses. Why are they going to the hippie movement? They need to go there for love. And just a minute here, I'm going to pull this up again. It's really interesting. I got, bless Carol Lynn Pearson, because she never throws anything away. She got me these transcripts of the group's meetings. And there's a really interesting conversation here where family just shows up and says, "Oh, I'm so glad to talk to you guys. We found marijuana in my son's house." And so the group says, "Well, have you fasted and prayed for them?" They said, "No." And Bill, this guy here who founded the group, he says, "You know, it's really interesting," and we'll get into this in a minute, the group. He said, "When you're on LSD, you can feel the influence of all the spirits around you, not just the satanic spirits," which they were big on talking about, the satanic spirits that got into you on drugs, but also the spirits of your family praying for you. And so for the group, they were really running into a lot of people who said, "We're so concerned about our kids," but they were not really reaching out. Anyway, let's move on to... I'm going to go ahead and... You guys can read along with me from the... It's the wrong one. You guys go ahead and read along with me here because I have some stuff written down. So, having established that, they really started to gather a lot of people. Here's another good quote about just sort of the notion that the gospel, you didn't know what it's for. This is from Alan Cherry, who's an early associate of the group. Some of you guys have probably heard of him. He was an early black convert. He said, when I talked to him, "For some, the gospel was kind of like green stamps. You were saving for something. You don't know what or for why. With the group, you had a youthful rebellion. You were rebelling from your parents' lackadaisicalness by being spiritual." I challenge you all to use lackadaisicalness in a sentence. So in the early days, there was just this incredible, incredible outpouring of stories about spirits. One member, during a seance, said he was possessed by numerous spirits, and they would go in and out of his body. And they would rip the... It felt like they were ripping the flesh right out of him. Cords that were part of his flesh were being torn out.
Gracious day, I'm just listening to what you're saying.
I get reactions. And this is, I want to read, actually, my mom has a really funny story about, well, not funny, but a story about sort of being chased around by an evil spirit. This is what she says. And then we started having all these really heavy experiences with Satan. He came home one night about 12 o'clock, and there was this horrible presence in my house. We didn't know what to do. Richard said he'd stay until I got to sleep. We weren't there more than 5 minutes when he said, "We're getting out of here." So we took my pillow and we drove around for a while. We didn't know where to go. We felt him, Satan, in the truck, too. He wouldn't go away. We went to Uncle Charlie's house. We knocked on his door at 1 a.m. He came and we told him this outrageous story and let me sleep in the front room, the mattress on the floor. And do you know, I could hear footsteps outside walking up and down the porch. There's a... Oh, goodness. There's another one. It's up here. This is the paper, because I was not foresighted enough to print it out. You can all read along with me. But one group member, his name was Dave, was having these intense flashbacks, and so he went to stay with Bill and his wife, and they gave him a blessing that the flashbacks would go away. And then the evil spirit tormented their home. And Bill said, "My wife acted stoned all night," right? Because they were equating these evil spirits with the kind of things that could, that supposedly when LSD opens your mind, it opens your mind to all sorts of spirits. So what you're seeing here is this incredibly charismatic idea that was another a really alive thing. The world around us is alive with spirits. They're trying to get us. But it's also alive with people's prayers and fasting and testimony. This is the exact opposite of the sort of cold atmosphere that they were critiquing, that the children had grown up in. And, let's see. One of the more interesting things is the notion that even through the priesthood, just telling someone about the gospel, drugs would totally lose their appeal. You know, there's that thing about the authentic ingredient, the synthetic ingredient. Here's a story Bill told about some heroin addicts that stayed at his house. He told one of them about the gospel, and he said, "Well, it really makes me feel good inside. I'd like to do what you're telling me about, and I'd like to repent. First, I need to go down to California and take care of some unfinished business, and then I'll be back." He promised never to go on heroin again. 20 minutes after he got to California, he's back on heroin. But this time was different. It didn't get him high. He called long distance and he was crying and he said to this girl, "I'm back on heroin, but it's different this time. It doesn't get me high anymore. It takes me off to the side. Now I feel trapped and I don't know what to do." This is, Bill says in this meeting, it's such a common thing among those who want to get out of drugs and who seek the Lord's help and receive a spiritual witness. They can't get high anymore. And can you believe that? And this is, I talked to another guy named Ron Spears. He gave me permission to use his name. I just love the language they use. Check this. I remember one time at Bill's house, there were three of us sitting around really getting off on reading the hymns. It was a sort of 60s construction. You wouldn't say that anymore. But this fellow came in. It took a minute. This fellow came in and was trying to quit drugs and had taken something. He was really sorry. We gave him a blessing and he came down immediately from his high. And so, because the good people here gave me a whole hour, I'm going to read you a very long notion of this possession. One night, two kids rushed this boy over to my house and they asked me to come out to the car. This fellow was really sick. I went out there and he was huddled up in the front seat. He was trembling all over. I said, "What is he on?" They said, "He's not on anything." I asked him what the matter was. They said they didn't know, so we took him into my house. I was really frightened because I couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. I said a little prayer. "Wow, Heavenly Father, what's wrong with this guy?" I just couldn't figure it out. But then I felt really impressed that he was possessed by an evil spirit. So I tried to talk to him a little bit. Found that during the day, he decided that he didn't want anything to do with drugs anymore and sex and some of the other things he was participating in. He wanted to repent. So I asked him about his faith, his belief in God, and the power of the priesthood. He said he believed in them. I asked him if he would like a blessing, and he said that he would. So I went across the street, got my elder's corn present, and we gave him a blessing. I had the privilege of saying the blessing. As I started, the boy was trembling. He was whimpering, not big sobs or anything, but a low whimper. As we proceeded into the blessing, he began to shake more and more. I felt the Spirit moving me to cast out in the name of Jesus Christ this evil influence that he had invited into his body because of the sin and the drugs he had been participating in. When I had rebuked the power of Satan, the Lord just swept him clean. His physical tabernacle was rid of the spirit of evil. He stopped trembling, he just sighed and relaxed in his chair. So there's all these notions that drugs are really connected to evil spirits. Bill really sort of summed up this attitude about, you know, we would love to get spiritism from drugs, but we can't, when he said, the same guy, Satan, who is influencing us to hate our fellow man, have prejudice and loathing in our heart, is the same guy who's giving us these drugs. You know, there's a lot of talk in there about Satan taking over you and Satan attacking you. Just a minute here. Now I'm going to pull up some more images. I talked about Alan Cherry a little bit, and this is a sort of interesting phenomenon that an early black convert got really connected to the church. Here we go. This is black and white. Oh, look, it's black and white, so it actually looks kind of decent. We'll zoom in on it. Alan Cherry was an early black convert to the church. He got connected to the group, sort of grandfathered in, he said. You know, he had smoked a little marijuana, but what's really interesting, I talked to him about this, you see a sort of outsider in the church subculture anyway. He's in, but not entirely in. But Alan went on tour with a lot of bands the group was involved in, and there's a quote in here, let's see. And when people would ask him, don't you want the priesthood, he'd say, power, prominence, pride, and position no longer have any appeal to me now that I've found religious truth. So you see, here we go. Also, this is fun, the bands. But also, Gerald Pearson was a member too, a homosexual member, who was somewhat honest about his orientation with some members of the group. Now, Carolyn, you know, has no details, but she said, I am positive he shared it with some members of the group. And at one point he was even talking in a little meeting they had about spirituality and sexuality. And he said, my sexual journey would make most of you very uncomfortable. Which Carolyn got very angry about. She said, because the gay thing was all over, right? Talked to her on the phone about that. She left. But so you see, this is really absorbing a lot of subcultures into the church. Into this vital, living, powerful movement. That was entirely based on this idea that their generation was really seeking truth. So I'm going to, now this is fun, I'm going to show you a band that some of them were in, the Sons of Mosiah, right on. So here's Alan Cherry and here's some other guys. There were two members of the group were from a San Francisco sound band, the whole scene that also produced the Jefferson Airplane, called the Moby Grape. You guys heard of them? Didn't ring any 60s bells? Two of them ended up in the group. Now let's see. Here's another one. My dad was actually in this one. This one's a lot of fun, and I have the flag. This is the Free Agency. And I'm going to play you guys some of their stuff. I'm going to get out this. It's just going to screech by.
Yeah. Oh, I don't think so. No.
Okay.
I'm going to plug this in and play you some Mormon rock and roll. That's right. You thought you weren't going to get rock and roll at Sunstone, did you? This stuff is really funny because the...
I'm talking to the mic.
What's that?
I'm talking to the mic. There. All right. It won't be picked up.
This stuff is really interesting because... You know, I at least am used to the music culture today. It's all do-it-yourself. You know, Radiohead killed the record companies last year. But in this day and age, in the 60s, of course, you had to get big, you had to get noticed by a record company. And so here are these kids making something that, as far as most people are concerned, had no commercial appeal. Alan Cherry said, only the young could be that crazy. That's what people always told us. Play a little piece, and you'll hear Alan Cherry talking about their Latter-day sound.
It's got to fast forward a little bit.
Jeff is keeping me in place. It's the first time I've done this. Okay. Oh my goodness. Where's my music? Oh, that's why I was whining about fast forward. Actually, let's make sure. That's your whining. It's been a while since I used a tape player. But this, these rock groups, an article back there, were they're really focused on the idea that they could reach out through music too to all these kids who are suffering.
And I'd like to take a few minutes to say a little more about the Free Agency.
This is Alan Jerry giving their sales pitch.
It's called Latter Day Sound, a unique combination of popular harmonies and rhythms. It's geared to emphasize a spiritual message. We spent more than a year developing this sound in answer to the common rock music, which often advances drugs, immorality, and revolution in a way that leaves many young people physically thrilled, but seldom spiritually inspired. In addition to what you'll hear on this tape, we've sent you a letter and other materials which describe the members of our group and our programs more fully. And in a moment, you'll hear a few selections from our concert program. But first, I'd like to tell you some things about our corporation. Four, the members of the Free Agency are also part of the Leahona Corporation. We formed this corporation, which we call the Family, to enable us to serve those we perform for in the best manner possible. For in this way, we can control and direct all phases of our performing, and unlike most groups, we can communicate the truth.
Some of you guys want to come up closer.
...and action, which is uncommon in the music industry. Through our Family, we are appealing to an ever-growing audience who desires truth, not illusion, in its entertainment. We'll now play four of our songs for you, entitled I Found My Way Back Home, Homeward, Put a Little Love in Your Heart, and Olive Leaf. We've included a song sheet, so if you wish, you can follow along as you listen. Now, the songs.
Okay. I'm hoping this won't make them angry in the other room. But, this is basically going to sound like Crosby, Stills, and Nash with more of the lyrics.
I came to the earth for a season to work.
Did you guys hear that?
Yeah.
Right, rocking, huh? Yeah. I put that on at my sister's house last night, and the kids danced to it. There's a... going to bring up an article here you guys can look at that Carolyn Pearson wrote for the... I think it was the Daily Universe. Long hair rock musicians belting out the joys of following Christ may sound paradoxical to some, but that's what the free agency is all about. All right. So,
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Why does Orrin Hatch's
name on that? Oh, gosh. Yeah, I forgot that. He was their financial backer.
Can you repeat the question, please?
Oh, why is Orrin Hatch's name on there? He actually was a financial backer for the free agency. And paid for a lot of their stuff, their equipment and recording. Back when he was just a humble, whatever he was before he was a senator, a lawyer. He was a lawyer, right? Okay. Thanks for keeping me on my toes. I'm going to show, this is their newsletter too. This is, this newsletter talks about how it was organized to become an official wing of the church. Let's see. It's the next page, I'm sorry. But basically, they had a lot of fasting and prayer. Fasting and prayer was involved with everything. And they fasted and prayed about the best way to deal with the fact that they were getting huge. And so, they finally got in contact with Marvin J. Ashton, Spencer W. Kimball, I believe, and a guy named Fred Markham of the Utah Stake, who organized the group into an official church calling. You know, you would have each group for each ward, and I've got too many images here. In fact, at one point, apparently they were going to have a play based on their experiences that Orson Scott Card was going to write. Like when he was a famous playwright, they got into contact with Scott Card, and he said, you know, there was something blow up where they didn't think he was doing it right, and he didn't do it anymore. Those of you guys who know Scott Card knows he likes to debate, so maybe I'm not surprised. But, I'm going to talk a little bit about where they went. I don't know too much about what happened in the later years of the group. If any of you guys know, I would welcome the information. I know that the gathering place in Orem was started by some of them, including a lady named Kristen Gardner. There's some happy stories and some sad stories. My parents, who, you know, were on drugs and chased around by the devil in the car, my dad went on to become a psychologist, And Ron Spears and Kristen Gardner, who were two early members, Ron Spears started reading the Bible when he was stoned in prison one day. they became involved in the gathering place. But then some stories, you know, are some more tragic. Gerald Pearson, most of you guys know, died of AIDS in the 80s. Bill, the guy who started the whole group, actually died of an overdose several years later, and he was not able to entirely get rid of the drugs. And you know, you hear different stories. Some of them are doing really well. Some of them my dad actually ran into in the drug recovery ward of the hospital where he worked in LA. And but this moment where they were so alive with this spiritual idea, with this idea that their generation was hungry for the things of the Spirit, and that their generation would be able to change things, would be able to change the way they looked at the church. I think this moment is really disseminated out through the church. The same way, you know, primary starts in one ward as someone's idea, and the church acquires it. I think this is one of the things that's really shaped us. I know that, personally, I felt a real disconnect from the church. I'm sure we all have. That's why we're here, right? Sometimes to gripe about what we hate about the church. Hopefully that's not the only reason why we're here, but I felt a real disconnect to the church, and I started reading these stories and felt like this is my story too. This generation is what made this generation. There's and so I was hoping I was hoping in the question and answer session maybe we could talk a little bit about what kind of ideas we've heard too that might have come out of this, or what kind of relation we've had to this. I'm going to open it up to questions right now.
Let me take the mic.
And let Jeff take the mic.
Thank you. Good presentation. Okay, we have lots of time for questions. Isn't that nice? We won't have to. Mike Quinn is the first questioner of the day.
Himself,
yes.
Because this group was organized on the basis of former drug use or current drug use, where they're trying to get off it, in Provo, right? I'm wondering to what extent they were afraid of or had experience with narcs infiltrating their group. Because when I, in 1973, moved to New Haven, Connecticut, there was one of the members of our ward there talked in testimony meeting about being a narc in Salt Lake City. He lived on the avenues and got ingratiated himself with the drug groups that were there, most of whom were attending the University of Utah, and then he turned them all into the cops. And so I was wondering, with Provo, and knowing what I know about BYU security, to what extent was this an issue with the group?
Wow, good question. You know, I didn't hear anything like that. I've certainly heard people talk about the dark side of the group, that there were some odd things happening. Ron, I think Ron Spears told me he knew about two early group members who became polygamists. No, I never heard that. That would be an interesting thing. I'm still following up. There's a lot of stories to tell. So I'll keep that one in mind.
Picture of the group on survival.
Oh, okay.
I'm Lynn. I'm the one who was...
Into the microphone.
Oh, okay, yes. Thank you very much for doing this. I've just begun talking to my friends again about group. I was in a pool hot tub with Paul Jensen a few weeks ago, told him all about group. The next day he calls up and said, hey, guess what? And by the way, it is group. We never called it the group. It was just group.
Yeah. Okay.
So we would say something like, group is holding a fast for Creed tomorrow night. Or group is, but it was never the group. So I'll pass this around. We did a survival trip to start the opening of the first gathering place, which was a drug rehabilitation center. We got funding from Utah County Council on Drug Rehabilitation. We all got involved in that one. And then Bill and I started the second one in Springville. So this is...
Yep, stay at the mic, please.
This is a journal that one of the group members sent to me that he took on one of our survival trips, this one right here. So you may not want to look at any of that, but picture.
I want to look at that. But
yeah, well, I want to look at that.
Oh, yeah.
Anything you have. But anyway, I was one of the group members who, I mean, you know, you said it was drug, people were taking drugs. At that point, I'd never even smelled a drug. I didn't even know what they were. You know, I mean, like, I obviously was involved with everybody and wasn't naive, but I hadn't taken drugs. So a lot of us weren't people who were taking or had taken drugs. We were drawn to group by its spiritual power. It was forced to be reckoned with. And I have some extraordinary experiences. Anybody who would like to talk about them, I would be happy to discuss them.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'd like to do a quick reality check before the before the next question. I've been involved in Mormon things for about 25 years. I've never heard of group. Has anybody else here never heard of group? Can I see a show of hands? Oh, you make me feel so good. Thank you. I thought there was something huge that I had just missed out on. All right, our next question.
As a BYU student in the early 70s, and heard of group, although I was never involved in it. I surmise, although you haven't said anything about it, that at some point the church stopped being interested in working with group. Is that true? And what I'd be interested in knowing is a little bit more about that phase of the group, how and when they withdrew, if they ever did, their support, and what effect that had.
I would be interested in that too. Lynn might know if you knew about the formation of the gathering place. Do you know anything about when the organization the church had set up sort of disseminated?
Well, we had our own regional representatives, and I wouldn't say there was a group for every ward. It wasn't that small. But we had group all over the countries. There was group in England and Australia and very, very many other places. So we had a regional rep who would attend group, and then I was part of, as I said, the original gathering place. We had our every meeting would start out with prayer, and we would fast to decide who we were going to hire and all that sort of thing. And Bill gave me a blessing once because I was thinking I was going to go east, and so he said in the blessing, "You will know when to make it known that you will leave group and when to leave." And I thought, why did he say those two things? But we were fasting to hire one person, and two people's names came up that had never happened. And so at that fasting moment, I said, well, you know, I am leaving, so we do actually need to fill two places. And so I left in 74 to go to Vermont, but it was still strong at that point. And I can't say what happened after that in relationship to the LDS Church, but it certainly did have a strong component up to that point. And I was kind of hoping this would be group reunion, but anybody? Yes?
That's my diary, too.
Yeah, oh, that's right. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so that I know up to 74.
I was wondering if Ernest Streck, the owner of Grandpa's Bookstore, was part of this. He used to have a bookstore just south of the campus, just a little ways, like a half a block. I haven't heard the name.
Having been married to Ernest Streck, I
can't. Wow.
Yes, I was one of those who got in polygamy for 4 years. So, yeah, I married Ernest Streck, the owner of Grandpa's Views Bookstore. He was a lover of the early LDS Church and had come here through spiritual means, guidance, and then joined the LDS Church and then searched into the original and was more attracted to that than the current one. And then as I was in Vermont those 4 years, I came back and people would say, "God, I meet this Ernest." And I said, "Oh, I've been in group with Ernest. I know him." And they said, "Yeah, but he's different now." So I did meet him, and I eventually married him, and I have two children by Ernest Streck. Ernest Streck was also a force to be reckoned with. He was a lover of documents. And when I heard that Mark Hoffman was bombing people, I went and gathered my family in because I thought Ernest was going to be one of the people because he had so many early documents, as I'm sure Michael can attest.
I have a question, because I frequently suffer from cognitive dissonance when I'm among the Mormons. And the idea of Mormons dropping acid just doesn't gel in my head. Can you clarify for me what happened in group? Were these people trying to recover from their addictions, or were they continuing to take the drugs as part of group?
They were trying to recover. It's a lot like AA. You know, people might come to AA who had a drink that morning, but they were there. I'm sorry if that wasn't made clear. That's the whole focus was in recovery, was in getting people to have these incredible spiritual experiences, prayer, fasting, blessings, cast out devils, you know, and realize that this was just as dramatic and as powerful as what was happening to them on LSD. So yes, it's recovery based.
And no one else is standing up. I have another question. Will you come on up? I'll ask my question. Another question. Do you, or does anybody here, have a sense of what... I don't know if I can ask for a percentage. I don't think so. But is there a visible sign that LDS youth today continue to be involved in drugs and things like that? Or is that simply not happening?
Well, my brother smokes a ganja once in a while. I think drugs are still, they're just part of the culture, and they're a lure for LDS kids. This is one reason why I really want to tell these stories. I want people to hear these stories, to know, because we don't hear this focus anymore. The same way that we don't hear the focus on peace, love, brotherhood, and drugs. We don't hear the same focus on peace, love, brotherhood instead of drugs. You know, drugs have sort of been disseminated, and I think there are a lot of kids out there, LDS kids who are taking them, who could use this perspective that the group had, that the church could be just as vitally of a spiritual place if they band it together.
So there remaineth faith,
hope, charity, and weed. Is that what you're saying?
They're done.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, I'm Steve Richardson. Something that I remember from the group that really impressed me at the time. Sorry. Something that really impressed me at the time was that they were singing a song that I'd only sung in junior Sunday school, you know, many years before, and that was "I'm a Child of God." Of course, now it's in the songbook we sing all the time, but it really impressed me. And if you think through it with that in mind, you know, think through the song with that in mind, well, then you get you can more impressed by what message it had for those kids.
Yeah. One of the things that's really interesting to me in doing this is how many times now do we hear people really in the church do say, "Don't let your calling take over your life"? I mean, that's one of the really heavy criticisms in this book, this little book, that is that these parents were letting the church callings take over their lives, or their professional lives take over their lives. And I wonder how much of the group coming out saying, you know, "My house is just cold and without love," eventually influenced this movement among the leaders to probably say, you know, "Big time for your family. Family time, family time." Of course, I can't say, but I like to think that was one of the influences.
Of course, there's a bumper sticker I've seen that says, "Jesus is coming, look busy." Maybe Mormons really take that seriously.
One frustration that some of us, well, I, speaking for myself, I sometimes have is that Mormonism seems to be so wed with political conservatism, and that's very frustrating to me anyway. I wonder if this group was hippie in a fuller sense. Were they also politically leftist? Were they against the war? Were they part of the anti-Vietnam War movement? And did they have correspondingly an alternate conception of the gospel about peace and love?
Great question.
That is a good question. Although I haven't found any specific talk about Vietnam, I found a lot of talk about peace and love and brotherhood. Also, to me, the fact that they attracted an early black convert and homosexuals also speaks to the fact that they were really liberal, at least in their approach. Eventually, they probably all had to fit into the church mold somehow. But they were really liberal and loving in their approach to anyone of a different orientation or a different worldview. Most of them were very concerned with finding answers about the priesthood ban. You see that a lot. You see that's one of the big roles that Alan Cherry filled, was to say that you can be Mormon, you can be black, and the Spirit can still be just as powerful on you, and you cannot have the priesthood. That was a big issue for them. So I think they were really liberal. I don't know about the war, but I think they were really liberal in favor of peace. There also might have been, again, this is probably in the 70s, if you talked bad about the Vietnam War in public, you might have ended up like Caleb in the BYU Honor Code discussion.
Okay, Armand. Armand Moss is with us today. Isn't that nice? Hello.
I don't know if I'm really entitled to participate since I was so late coming in.
Late Armand Moss.
It occurred to me that has anybody made any comparisons between this phenomenon among the LDS and what was happening with the transformation of the drug culture about the same time in Christianity more generally? One of the research projects I got involved in, along with Mormon studies, and actually before I got deeply involved in Mormon studies, was the study of a group in the Northwest that sometimes went by the name of Christian Brothers. They were based in Spokane, Washington, and were part of a larger phenomenon of the 1960s and 70s called Jesus Freaks. And one of the interesting things that I and my collaborator found about this particular group of Jesus Freaks was the use of religion as a way of getting out of the drug culture. And the slogan used to be "Getting High on Jesus." And so we followed some of the folks who were involved in this over a period of 3 or 4 years. And one of the most interesting things that happened was that a large minority, by no means the majority, but a large minority of the so-called Jesus freaks went on to become active in Protestant Pentecostalism. And to this day, you will find them now in their much later years, prominent in organizations like the Calvary Chapel, the Vineyard Christian Fellowship, and certain more conventional Pentecostal churches. So I see a parallel here, although apparently I hadn't heard of the group either as an LDS group. Apparently, it was important in dealing with people who were already LDS, but the phenomenon I'm talking about was dealing with people whose own religious or Christian backgrounds were quite fragmentary or non-existent, but who came into Christian Pentecostalism / fundamentalism as part of their therapy in leaving the drug culture and instead getting high on Jesus. It just seemed to me there's an interesting parallel there of substituting the one, you know, religion for the drugs.
Thanks, sir.
Yeah, that's there's actually, I was having a conversation with the fellows in my master's program with me whose parents were Jesus freaks. And we started talking about our parents, and we could have been talking about the same people. You know, so yes, there's a definite parallel. There's a definite attempt to unite because those hippie ideals with, you know, Jesus's ideals, because Jesus was a bit of a hippie himself, wandering around with long hair and sandals and preaching brotherhood. What was he thinking?
Anybody else? Well, this has been a great discussion. Thank you all very much.